Hello, I'm Ian Danter, and this is the Commentator's Curse Show that aims to lift the lid on the weird world that us commentators inhabit. I've been doing radio commentary for over 20 years now, and this series has already introduced you to a number of colleagues of mine in the modern day press box. The archive of all the previous episodes is there to enjoy in the place where you found this one. Now, I'm actually just pre-recording my introduction just for today, as I really don't want to embarrass my very special guest with a gushing live introduction that might put him off. Because my solo guest this week is Barry Davis, one of the original football commentators once television had made the beautiful game a regular part of its programming as the 1960s became the 1970s, and a man who I loved listening to commentate more than pretty much anyone else on football, other than perhaps the late David Coleman or indeed the late great Hugh Johns in their pomp. Barry was not only an accomplished football commentator, but also turned his hand to a staggering variety of other sports, including tennis at Wimbledon, plus a plethora of Olympic events over his illustrious career. I should tell you that my late father loved his delivery too, and many's the time the old man and me sat together enjoying Barry on the mic. I especially remember once during Mexico 1986, where we stayed up late, as many of you would have done, as England had to beat Poland to advance from their group. Gary Lineker Jr. obliged with a hat-trick, much to Barry's obvious delight. He called that game so beautifully. He's a while retired now, but as you'll hear from this interview, he's lost none of his sparkle or opinion. And it's no exaggeration to tell you how privileged, truly privileged, I feel to have spoken to him. So here is my conversation with Barry Davis. Barry, thank you so much for joining us on The Commentator's Curse. It's a pleasure to finally meet you, even if it is only virtually. When we start looking back at your career, we have to start with a tinge of sadness, of course, because the man who gave you your break for British Forces broadcasting, Gerald Sinstad, so sadly passed away yesterday. Terrible shame.
Yes. I mean, he had a good innings, and I've worked out that I knew him around 60 years, not quite. He having done some work for British Forces Broadcasting during my time in the army, he previously worked at the same place in Cologne, BFN Cologne, it was known then. And the chap who succeeded him, a guy called Alan Grace, sent a recommendation and so on. And in fact, our first meeting was not too successful because Jerry painted a pretty black picture of how difficult it would be to make it into any connections in broadcasting. I had no background other than the rather exaggerated amount that I impressed upon him that I had done. So I left Broadcasting House and came home living then in Herne Bay in Kent, really quite depressed about the whole thing. And I remember going for a walk, taking my dog for a walk and sort of discussing it with him, as it were, walking along the coastline there. And then suddenly, 2 days later, he rang me and said, would I like to come along on Saturday? And basically, to make it short, I wasn't quite the tea boy. I never had a permanent job there. But my task on a Saturday was to stand behind Eamon Andrews and check the script that he was about to say. And it would be my fault if possibly said something that was wrong. Anyway, Gerald supported me all the way through. You didn't have to show any cards or anything in those days to say who you were. So I just turned up, and he and Brian Moore between them helped me enormously. And then Jerry and I sort of crisscrossed, because he went to work for Anglia Television. I did the World Cup, which I think he may have done some for radio in 66. Mm-hmm. I don't know why ITV didn't grab him then, to be honest. And then I was at ABC Television and then at Granada. And when I left Granada on an offer from the BBC, he succeeded me at Granada. So our careers have sort of intertwined. He was a lovely guy, had a great vocabulary, knew when to use words and when not to, and so on. He was excellent. And his knowledge of opera was, I understand, quite extraordinary. Mine isn't sufficiently great to judge his, but I know that he did a lot of work. In fact, he gave up anything to do with sport for a couple of years, I think. Okay. And then came back to it, did a few World Cups for ITV and so on and so forth. And I was due to go up and see him. He hadn't been well for some time, and I gather, talking to his wife, that he really was going downhill the last 10 weeks.
The one thing that Jerry did do was call out racist abuse that he noticed in that quite iconic West Bromwich Albion win at Old Trafford back in 1978. I don't know whether you remember that, Barry, but it was a very big 5-3 win that West Brom achieved. And Brendan Batson, Laurie Cunningham, Cyril Regis were all targeted that day. And Jerry called it out in commentary, which in those days was... I mean, it's striking when people do it now, but back in 1978, that was pretty seismic.
Yes, absolutely, and very typical. I applauded him for that. I did some of that myself, but obviously the 3 degrees and the manager who, in the end, got kicked out of ITV for something, a chance remark made. Anybody less racist I have not met. I mean, but he had a way of talking which he couldn't do now in the dressing room. They wouldn't put up with it.
When we go back a little bit further, what duties were you performing at British Forces Broadcasting that led to Gerald Sinstat approaching you in the first instance?
No, I approached Gerald Sinstat. This guy called Alan Grace rang me and asked me if I would do some stuff on the local services league. I was a sort of unofficial sports officer for my unit. I did have an army job as well, but I love games, and I were many better footballers than I was, and I played both rugby and football when I was in the army. Yeah. But there were many better players than me. And I remember it very well, coming down into the mess on a Friday night, bumping into the engineering officer, and said, "I gather you on BFN on Sunday." I said, "Well, no, not exactly. I'm going down there to give them news about local matches and so on. I've got to ring around a few people." And he said, "Well, that's not what they just said. They said, join us and we're going to welcome a new recruit, et cetera, et cetera." It started there. And I went to do a bit of commentary, very little, but enough to persuade Jerry a little bit, although he knew the system well, so would have known I was probably exaggerated. But it served me well when it came round to the 66 World Cup, because if it hadn't been in England, you wouldn't be bothering to talk to me now. That fact, it was absolutely crucial to my career, because ITV were the new boys on the block. They only had one commentator of note, and they had various trials. And as Frank Keating, who was then working for Thames Television, the Guardian, reporter of note, much missed these days, he said that I woke them up in the second half when they were trying people for 10 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes. They brought them back to life, and that helped.
What intrigues me, Barry, about that yourself, and obviously Hugh Johns, who's ITV commentator, and Kenneth Wolstenholm on the BBC in that era. Me as a commentator now working on radio, I have so many frames of reference that I can call upon from the generations of commentators that have come before me in terms of how I develop and how I soak up their good points like a sponge and try and incorporate that into my style. I can't think what frames of reference you yourself would have had, if any, for developing your own commentary style in the outset.
Well, I mean, Kenneth Wolstenholme was the commentator in the land. David Coleman then really took over from him in the early days of me being at the BBC. Mm. And I got some matches fairly early on in the Match of the Day, but we're now moving on to 1969. And I left ITV, having had 2 years of ABC television and one at Granada. Yes, I mean, I think at the time, and I put the line in my book, I hadn't really thought much about what I did. When I got the Match of the Day, which clearly was the ambition of everybody at that time. Hugh Johns by then was the number one for ITV, and then Brian Moore took over. And then Hugh took over back from him at the World Cup because Brian was used as the presenter.
Yes.
Hugh and I once did a match in the trials I was talking about, not quite side by side, but close to. And we could hear each other's lines and found afterwards we compared notes and we were finishing each other's sentences. He was a great guy. I mean, he was a wonderful voice.
He was the voice of my youth in the Midlands, growing up in Birmingham.
Yeah, and of course the thing did spread. The reason the BBC wanted me was that they were going to do local matches, local area matches, and then one big match on Match of the Day. Mm-hmm. So you would have the unfortunate choice of phrase, so big match, the main match, and going to Leeds, to Birmingham, to whatever, to take the match from that region. Yeah. Region. But the idea didn't work very well. We didn't have the equipment. One or two were done on film. I remember a match at Newcastle when the film cameraman pointed his camera up to the sky and it was pouring with rain. And I thought, really, say, what's going on here? But you know, you need a bit of luck, don't you, to have the right matches at the right time and so on.
There's this story which you will be able to corroborate, I'm sure, that when you were set to do a game in Leeds, David Coleman suddenly came down poorly with a case of the flu and you had to dash down south to do a Match of the Day main match when ordinarily you would have been up in Leeds.
Yes, that's almost right. Ken Wolstenholme, I don't know why he wasn't working that day. I think he was the one who was down with flu.
Right.
David just lost his voice. And, you know, I was sitting quietly at breakfast with my new boss, as it were, director for the day. And suddenly I was being whipped off back to London. Rather upset his breakfast. He wasn't the man who chatted to at breakfast. He was a lovely guy, but he liked his own way and his own whiskey.
You're suddenly doing a match for which you had not prepared a single note.
No, exactly right. And a match of a team that had just been promoted, so I wouldn't have done ever in my life, Crystal Palace. Mm. Manchester United, though, having worked for Granada, that was a relative piece of cake, but it was a touch difficult, but what was the choice and what was the opportunity? And it went well enough. And I then went back into the studio. Frank Boff was brought in to introduce Match of the Day. Mm-hmm. And I did the interviewing of two of the Crystal Palace guys. It was a 2-2 draw. Mm-hmm. I remember something that you perhaps wouldn't hear now. Both of them admitted they had made mistakes in the match, but were crucial. Yes, exactly. Your reaction to that. I don't think that would happen too much now.
Not a chance. Not unearthly of a chance. We, as commentators now, we are spoilt, Barry, in terms of the resources that we can draw upon when we are preparing for a game. People who work for television have stat packs sent to them that one man is employed by, whether it BBC or Sky, to collate information. You know, they can tell you what Aaron Wan-Bissaka has for tea on Tuesdays, for goodness sake. How did you prepare for games? Was it the old Rothman's yearbook that was your Bible, or what?
It was, but we had a fellow called Albert Sewell, who was the BBC main man, and he put out notes for us, but we had to do our own research, added to what he gave us. But I learned reasonably quickly that sometimes research can get in your way. And I tried to go to matches with an open attitude. I was too excitable in those early days, although people at Leeds United would tell you that wasn't the case, and I was absolutely right with what I said about Leeds United and the offside goal against West Bromwich Albion.
Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, which cost that referee the cup final, in my opinion. It was a shame, actually. I mean, it wasn't an error, in my opinion, and Leeds would all agree with that. But if you have something you're desperately keen to get in, and you think about it, and particularly with editing stuff, you want to put it in at the right moment with a good chance. You know, the goalkeeper makes a good save, and then you get your line in. But I found it got in the way. I wanted to say it as I saw it. And I was not as sort of keen on knowing that it was his 25th strike on goal and the first time he'd succeeded or whatever. I think, frankly, there's too much of that now. And in a live match, when you've got so much time, why the need to immediately say, that's his 85th goal for his country, whatever. I mean, if it's 100th, okay. But you've got plenty of time to say that.
Yeah.
My attitude was, I went, as it were, as a spectator with my programme. And if the game got a bit boring, and I was, you know, as a watcher, not doing commentary, I might look at my programme. And that's how I view statistics. And I didn't use as much of them as some others.
The other way in which we're cosseted these days, Barry, as commentators, is the environment in which we get to work. Gantries, in your day, were much more rudimentary buildings than the very highbrow places that TV commentators get to work from now.
Yes, particularly when those lovely games with the underdog, the unknown team, who suddenly were at the centre of football's attention because they were playing a big team. I can't honestly say that Burnley was pretty cramped, I remember. I don't know what that's like now. Mm. But even the best stadiums, I mean, the Real Madrid Stadium is level with the 18-yard line, or it was in my day. These things are sent to trash.
Yeah, they most definitely are. I think most TV gantries are a little more welcoming, shall we say, than they might have been in the 1970s.
The best one, it was quite a low position, was Southampton. Mm. And the main thing about Southampton was that somebody used to come with a tea tray at half time with really quite exquisite china on and cup of tea, pour the tea. It's really rather nice. I almost missed the start of a kickoff for the second half once.
When you go back to 66, and the commentaries you were doing, like Italy, North Korea, not many of those games were live because there was just one game that was selected by BBC, and it was usually England. So you had to bide your time before you actually got a live commentary that went out across the nation, which I think was in 1970 in the Mexico World Cup.
Probably.
Uruguay, Italy?
Remember it well. It was one of the most boring matches of all time. And what made it worse, as I was commentating on this match, I was picking up wherever Kenneth Wilson was. Somehow I got that in my ear.
Yeah.
I couldn't get rid of it. There had been technical problems with the Mexicans at that time. I mean, recorded and obviously on Match of the Day and things and the big match indeed, They had a bit more time, but I don't think that commentators were given any replays of any incidents actually at the time. I mean, Marty and I used to say what we saw, recap the goal, and they used to match it with the edit in the studio.
Right, that's quite clever.
Yeah, because you could be fairly wildly wrong. But I think we had a pretty good record, actually. Okay. We just, John and I, what we did.
Needs must as the devil drives. How much, a lot of the commentators I talk to, Barry, have done a lot of radio. I don't know how much radio commentary you did in those days. I know in more recent times, Absolute Radio brought you back.
Yes, they did.
But how much radio did you do back in the day?
No, I had very little experience. That was the occasion when I suggested that I had more than I'd had. I did more in Germany than here. I never did a radio commentary here before, absolutely never for the BBC.
When that was suddenly thrown at you by Absolute, how did that go for you?
It was hard work. It's a different art, in my opinion. I mean, the radio commentator is painting word pictures. The television commentator should be adding to the pictures if he can, or identifying people at suitable moments. It is a different job, but it's got so mixed up now with people going from Tuesday night working for radio and Wednesday night working for television that it's rather lost its way in a way.
Yes.
There are more people in the commentary box and more people talking and so on and so forth.
Well, so, this is a very interesting point with yourself, because you straddled, Barry, those two eras where up until, I'm trying to think what World Cup it would have been, let's take World Cups as an example, where for the first four or five World Cups that you covered, you were Osolo Mio in the commentary box. But yeah, as maybe once we got into the 80s, certainly I remember Jimmy Hill being stood alongside you in 86 in Mexico. So you had all those years where you had, there was no elbowing anybody else out of the way, and suddenly you have to deal with another aspect of commentary.
Yes, it became commentary when it first started. I mean, Don Revie was very good at it. It was called the summarizer in those days, he would every sort of 10 minutes make a point, tactical, yeah, so on and so forth. And I thought that was more successful, frankly, possibly because it suited my style better. And sometimes we had a little natter about it. And I have always said, Mark Lawrenson, who I really enjoyed working with, the plenty that I did, yeah, with Brooking and lots of other people. But I mean, Mark is a great one for the throwaway line. And it drives me mad when the commentator picks up out of him. It should be left so that people take in the point, the double entendre that was deliberate or whatever. But I mean, Jimmy Hill, actually, at the start of Maradona's run, was still talking about the fact that he didn't like this 12 o'clock kickoff. He hadn't had time to have his breakfast. I mean, not on air, but off air, he was saying. I always felt that the commentator should do the first replay. And in the end, I had to give up on that. Because,
yeah. Well, Motti tells a story once about how, because in those days, I think there was still only just the one microphone up on the gantry. You didn't have a microphone each, much like with Murray Walker and James Hunt with the Grand Prix. And Jimmy would be forever trying to snatch the microphone out of Motti's hand. I'm presuming he did the same with you.
Yeah, from time to time. He once succeeded. Motti tells a better story. I'll tell you his, unless you're going to talk to him, or perhaps you
won't. No, carry on.
But with Jimmy, with me, he had the microphone when someone was making a run, and he killed him and did a little bit of commentary. I can't remember the name of the player, but the shot was just over the bar. It was a close run thing. And when he came back to me, I said, Jimmy, Well done, but thank you very much on behalf of John Maltzen and me, because you have actually justified our positions, because he had said Brown and it was James or something like that. I mean, I said it laughingly. I got a bit told off about it. Motti had a classic case where Jimmy was commentating and the goal was scored. And his face was a little bit like the expression that you tells the story. But then, to his absolute delight, he saw a linesman's flag up and the goal was just loud. So he had to explain why it was that Jimmy had the moment.
That's absolutely glorious.
But it was good teamwork. But you work better with some than others.
Sure.
I had some sympathy for, because Motti and I have agreed many times that one of the reasons for our longevity in the job with the BBC is that we had very different styles. And I often thought that the expert, in quotes, co-commentator, which I don't think should be the word, because that's taking away his expertise. I mean, you should give him a title that justifies, you know, he played 100 times for England. I think I played 2 minutes. it could be quite difficult.
The ones I enjoyed most from your perspective, Barry, when you work with people like David Pleat, who such a wealth of knowledge, but as a manager, I don't know, there was something he brought to the commentaries with you that I really, really enjoyed. There was a coaching aspect to it that...
Yes, absolutely. And he didn't want to come in on every moment. He had difficulties with pronunciation of some foreign players from time to time, which we used to laugh about. In the 98 World Cup, I spent a lot of time with him. And he was very good. I enjoyed working with him.
Well, the 98 World Cup brings me to one of my most favourite commentary moments that you've ever had. The Bergkamp goal in the Stade Velodrome against Argentina, which, if you take the goal in isolation, is, in my opinion, the greatest World Cup goal because of the importance of the goal, the time that was left, the skill required to score it. I even place it personally slightly above Maradona in 86, just because of the timing. There's next to no time to go, and he's flipping won the game. Your commentary... I seem to think that, again, David Pleat might have been talking about something tactically and suddenly De Boer's hit this raking 80-yard pass downfield and you've quickly got to take over.
Yeah. I mean, it was a great pass. I was getting the De Boer's mixed up, but it was one of the...
I think it was Frank.
Yeah. It was pulled down. I mean, the ankle and the instep of the foot absolutely clearly. I nearly went off the sound thing, according to the sound supervisor. It was an amazing goal.
It was. But were you not asked to re-record it for a subsequent kind of review of the year package? Because I heard it somewhere re-commentated by yourself, but the commentary, yeah, it certainly wasn't peaking in the levels in the way that the original... You were asked to re-record it because of that?
Well, I mean, you could be right. There was a BBC Two night of football once, and one or two things had to be re-recorded.
Right.
Actually, particularly the beginning of Maradona's run for the second goal, because Jimmy was, I think I said earlier, he wasn't talking about
Yeti.
But he was. It was just a passing comment. And no reason not, because nothing was going to happen. Maradona was facing the wrong way. But then he turned. And I mean, that was the comparison between the two goals personal terms, between possibly my worst moment, well, no, definitely my worst moment in commentary, and my best, possibly my best.
Oh, you're referring to the handball, the hand of God.
It's quite simple. I didn't see it. What I did was to break my own rule, which I tried to live by. If you don't have something to say. You don't know, don't say anything. And I was trying to work out why the players were complaining. And I offered the thought that maybe they thought it was offside, which was ridiculous. I mean, the ball had come off Hodge, I think, was it came off the outside of the English player's boot and went down. So no way in the rules. I don't really understand offside these days. In those days, I mean, I'm somebody who says that Danny Blanchflower had it absolutely right. If you're not interfering with play, what the hell are you doing on the pitch? And some of them, it's got better this year. Mm-hmm. But it's some part of me is quite pleased that I don't have that problem. There are lots of problems on commentators these days that have to do that, and the television guys have to involve themselves with social media.
I have to tell you, Barry, one of the joys I have as a commentator is when I get to do an EFL game or even a Papa John's trophy game, as I did at Ipswich on Tuesday night, where there is no VAR. It's a VAR-free zone. And so, you know, the call that's made is the call that counts at the time. So that does take an awful lot of pressure off me and my summarising.
To be honest, I still think that's how it should be. I think that referees should have the final say, and that if they don't want to call up, if they have doubts in their minds, they should have the right to call and not be told, unless it's a quite ridiculous thing that they got wrong. And would there be any referees who did that? No, not possible. I just think there's too much reference. And quite often, the referee has got it right in the first place. And I think some of them, I haven't seen enough football to say that necessarily this is right. Some of them, I think, when they don't know, feel, well, I've got a second pair of eyes, so I'll call him up and see what he thought.
Quite possibly. There are certain referees that do appear to use it as more of a crutch, shall we say, than others. But that's a debate for another day, perhaps. Barry, one of the other great things about you as a commentator is your sheer versatility. Football, of course, was your regular for many, many years, working for the BBC on Match of the Day and World Cups and FA Cup finals. And I don't really want to get into the whole Motson Davis thing. It's been done. You've talked about it countless times, and I very much doubt that you would want to go through all that nonsense again. What I would really like to talk to you about is the sheer diversity of sports that you covered as an Olympic commentator, and whether there were any Olympic sports that you found particularly challenging compared to the football commentaries that you were used to.
Yes, I had a near miss with fencing. Peter West was supposed to get the fencing and he got blocked somewhere. I can't even remember which games it was. It was fairly early on in my career. Mm-hmm. And I was dispatched to go to fencing. I would have got it totally the wrong way around. Because when the light comes on as to whether you score the point or conceded the point. It's a good job. I went to do weightlifting, which is something that I don't particularly have interest in, but again, I was a jack of all trades and master of Sweet Funny Adams. And I sat myself next to John Goodbody, who is very knowledgeable on a number of sports, but that is one of his where he had the expertise, and it was shown and then put on the replay at night and done as live commentary from the studio 2 hours later. And he mentioned over one lift, he said, "Oh, crikey, I'm surprised he got away with that." So on commentary in the evening, I said, "Oh, I'm something similar to what he said." And everybody thought I was an expert on weightlifting. I didn't know anything about it at all, really. I've enjoyed doing sports, the other things and the other challenges. I hope I'm not being conceited when I say that I think that the task that I was given actually made me a better commentator on the one that I joined the BBC to commentate on. I think I was more aware of other sports and other things. I think sometimes football is a bit like this. And when you try to, sitting in a hut at Putney, try to call the finish of the boat race at Mortlake, and the distance between the two boats is 1 foot, you know you had that's what happened.
Yeah, that's a challenge that many could not rise to. The boat race, of course, can be a foregone conclusion by the time they've got anywhere near Putney Bridge. You know,
it can be. I had some very good years of better races or quality crews, and working with two experts in the field. And it was quite a long 4.5 miles. It's quite almost 4.5 miles. It's quite a long time for them to go and to have experts having a real time to you know, every point of things.
Of course, you created some iconic commentary as a hockey commentator with Great Britain's win. You know, Sean Curley, Imran Shumani, where were the Germans? And frankly, who cares? It's wonderful that you get known and have iconic lines as a football commentator, but to be able to straddle that, and if that commentary had happened now, you know as well as I do, thanks to social media, you would have gone viral.
I'm a bit embarrassed when people stop me in the streets and say, you remember when you said so-and-so about my team? Sometimes I don't remember. There are some lines that people have brought back. I mean, that, in a way, that was quite a simple remark, and in a way, it was a bad piece of commentary because I was taking sides. But it was the third goal of the final for England, for Great Britain, I beg your pardon. And it was clear in my mind that Great Britain were going to win the gold medal. I just didn't see Germany coming from a two-goal deficit. Unfortunately, I was right on that. So when I looked at the replays, I was thinking to myself, well, you know, they really cut the Germans to threads there. So I looked at it and said, where were the Germans? And I'm thinking in my mind, just stuff where the Germans were. You know, we're going to win this thing. And I just said what came to mind. And it wasn't until I got back to England that I realised what an effect it had. And it was got put on the front of some things that the boys did. I got to know them. In many ways, that day was the best day of my sporting career for all of the football things, because these guys were basically amateurs. And they had a bit of an up and down during the course of the competition and so on and so forth. I only did the semi-finals and final, but I'd done the World Cup. I did the World Cup 2 years before, or whatever it was. I really enjoyed it. I was deputy to Peter West going back to the Olympics in Germany, which was 72?
Yeah. That's right.
I always have to think about World Cups. I've done too many of them. That's why I've been so lucky.
I don't mind you taking sides, Barry, as you just mentioned in that previous answer. That was, for me and my dear old dad, that was part of your charm, in the sense that I think back, if we think back to your final World Cup for the BBC in Japan and South Korea, the golden goal, An Jung-hwan scoring against the Italians, you somehow managed to combine the joy of the South Koreans inside the stadium, but you were still able to berate the Italians for spurning the opportunity that you saw they had. That was part of your charm, Barry, that ability to wag the finger, if I may say.
That goal, I mean, that scene, I remember all my life, the South Koreans all in red and jumping up and down. And I mean, there was all sorts of criticisms about the game against Italy, the game against Spain, and so on and so forth. I was congratulated by a BBC producer. In fact, that was my last ever pieces in World Cups when I finished World Cup. He said to me, he congratulated me for the way I treated the moment. He said, "You didn't say a thing for at least 25 seconds. And I said, "What the hell was there to say?" It was being expressed by the crowd and the reaction of, you know. And then I said to him, "I'm the world's greatest commentator when I keep my mouth shut."
Well, do you know what? That's come up in the last 24 hours with Jerry Sinstat's passing because of the David Fairchild goal against San Etienne. He left that lovely, lovely pregnant pause whilst Anfield exploded with joy, and then just said, "Super sub strikes again," and that's all he felt he needed to say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he, as we've already discussed, I mean, played a part in my career and several other people's careers, and was a fairly knowledgeable guy. I was extremely helpful, and I'm really, really sad that it happened. I'm particularly sad as I fear I'm not going to be able to go to his farewell because I'm due to go to America next week. Having waited all this time, I can't cancel. I think my wife would probably go already.
If I think about another iconic moment in your career, you may regard this as very much throwaway, but all the managers that you used to interview, Brian Clough always is at the top of most people's lists. But I do really strongly remember, Barry, your final interview with Brian when Forest had been relegated. And you just said, all you said to him at the end of the interview, because he said he wanted to go and see his grandchildren, and you just said, "It's been a pleasure to know you, sir." And you made Brian Clough, the whole veneer drops, and you see the emotion suddenly thundering to the surface, and he was close to tears. This is a man who had so many different personalities, it would appear, within the frame of one man.
He's the only person who's kissed me on the cheek on television. Only managed, kiss me. I was very fond of Brian. I mean, there were lots of sides to him.
Is he ever tough on you as an interviewee? Because John Motson talks about interviews where he always felt Cluffy was trying to test him from moment one. Did you get that feeling with Brian?
No, I didn't. I mean, he wasn't going to miss an opening, but he wasn't like Kenny Dalglish, who once of the one thing that used to worry me about doing commentary on so many different sports, much as I enjoyed it all, was that I would get the wrong Christian name to the wrong player, as it were. And I got the Christian name of his goalkeeper that day, Blackburn Rovers. And he said, "I don't have a goalkeeper." I mean, he really put me on the spot, and it was really embarrassing. Now Brian wouldn't have done that, not in that way. Mm. And yet, there's another occasion when interviewing Kenny Dalglish, who I did a little bit of help for the DVD that they made about him. When Liverpool played Southampton in the day when you could pass the ball back, and it was a League Cup thing, and it was as boring as hell, and they passed the ball back many times because the replay was going to be in Anfield and they knew they'd win that. And to my amazement, I got a request from back at base, interview with Kenny Dalglish, and I thought, bloody hell. And when he came out, I said to him, "Kenny, I've been asked to interview you." I said, "What the hell are we going to talk about? I have no idea. Have you got any ideas?" 15 minutes later.
Oh my God.
We talked about the difference between being a player. I think I've exaggerated 50. But we talked about the difference between the manager and a player manager. And he was fascinating. I don't think very much got on the air. But there was nothing to say in the match. I mean, he agreed with me. It was boring.
Yeah.
They'd done what they set out to do. They didn't want take too many risks.
I've only ever had one experience of Kenny, post-match. That was after a win at Aston Villa, and he was quite full of bonhomie and cheer. So it was a relatively straightforward chat. And I never ever had the task of interviewing Sir Alex Ferguson, who, I mean, everybody tells me it was just, you know, good luck was basically the phrase that everybody said to one another. You had no idea which Sir Alex Ferguson you were going to encounter on that particular day.
Well, I can only tell you that he said both to John and to me at different times when he was refusing to talk to the BBC, when, in my opinion, the BBC should have... Well, let's put it this way. It was a famous occasion when Don Revie thought, when he was the England manager, that I had spent the Tuesday night, the match against Wales, in the home international championships. He said I'd spent the entire match being critical of the team and being critical of him and so on and so forth. Said after the cup final that he wouldn't, after the England Scotland game, which England had also lost, he said that he would not talk to me. I was the interviewer. And he got the message back from the head of sport that, okay, he was entitled to his opinion, but he wouldn't talk to anybody else at the BBC either if he wouldn't accept. We make our choice of who does the interview. I think the BBC probably should have done that with Ferguson.
Yeah.
They were fine. People who made the decision to find out. I never, ever had any problems. Going back to John and I, when Alec was not prepared to cooperate at all with the BBC, so we asked, he said to John, and he said to me on separate occasions, it's nothing to do with you. He didn't have to say that. The best interview I ever did with him was with Joe Royal before the cup final. 95, I did the interview with them. It wasn't live; it was recorded. But I mean, the idea of the managers talking before the cup final was ridiculous. But I mean, nobody really thought about it before. But these two knew each other very well; they were good friends, and I believe still are. And he really put everything in perspective, Alex. We've gone through all sorts of things. And he said, yeah, well, it's kind of being a manager. So, you know, you go to the match, you try to get everything right, something goes wrong and you lose and you go home and you put your key in the door. And immediately your wife says, you know, that gardener didn't come again today. He said, it brings you down to earth. And it's, he reacted laughing at his own remark. But I thought, you know, this is not quite the man that he's sometimes painted. Equally, we've been doing a piece about Cantona. I was doing it for somebody. He wouldn't come on because because his son was doing the program, which I've never seen.
Right. Have you? Right. Before we wrap things up, there are a couple of things that you've been able to do outside of the commentary work. You did get conscripted to work on a computer game as a commentator, Actua Soccer. Which I can only be assumed would have been a laborious task, or was it not as laborious as I might think it was?
I made it more laborious by saying to them, if you want to make this realistic, if you've got the ball with Jones, and he's identified Jones, he's now making a run towards goal. So if you want to say something again, it should be a bit up, and then in the end, when the goal is scored, it's got to be, if it's going to be realistic in commentary, that's how it would go. So that meant I had to do it for what they thought would just be one word. I was doing three and sometimes four. So it did take time, but it got very good reaction.
When Big Train approached you...
I wondered whether you were about to go there.
For the staring competition, did you almost dismiss it out of hand or
yes.
Did you really?
I got a phone call about it But they persuaded me to go down to have a look where they would record it. And well, walked in the room and there are these two figures. Because I just didn't know how could they do this. But I thought there might be people involved in it. I wasn't a Kent Walton of the time of wrestling. No way I wanted to be involved. Yeah. They said, "Well, go and give it a try." And I said, "Oh, so I just gave it a try. Just me. He wasn't the comedian. Wasn't there at the time." And by the time I'd got home, they'd rung and my wife had the message that they want you to do it. So I decided, okay. People still remember it. I mean, we had a script, and then we said, okay, right, now we're going to do it off the cuff. And they mixed the two things together.
Oh, right.
So it had a certain amount of reality about it. I mean, a lovely bit about the nude lady walking across the back, and one or two other things. I mean, it was hilarious, absolutely hilarious.
The other thing I must ask you about, and you're going to have to, and you may not remember this, Barry, but please indulge me if you can. We mentioned the Olympic Games, and you've commentated on opening and closing ceremonies at various Olympics, both summer and winter. Now, very rarely have I ever known you to be lost for words during any broadcast, but I am a big fan of the rock band Kiss from the United States. Now, the closing ceremony of the Salt Lake City Winter Games, I think it was. So this would be late 90s, early 2000s. There was a point in the closing ceremony where Kiss, in their full makeup and costumes, floated across a rink playing a song as part of the closing ceremony. And you were totally, clearly were not prepared for it or had never seen anything like it. And you were utterly incredulous as to what you were witnessing. Does that chime with you at all? Do you remember that moment at all?
The closing ceremony, you really can't prepare for it. You don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I'm fond of music, but I am not an expert in any way on pop groups of my ages. What I've learned from my children. So I can't remember that particular occasion.
No.
I do remember that was one of the more difficult ones because it was bitingly cold at the opening ceremony, and the security and everything was so bad. And we were made to wait. I thought I was going to get to my position and get everything worked out. And instead of that, I stood in a queue for a very long time, trying to wait to get into the stadium. And it was all because the American president's car had deposited him, but had not left the arena. So the driver suddenly became the most important person in the world, apparently, because we all had to wait. And instead of having an hour to sit and sort it all out, I had about 15 minutes, top whack. So it was quite difficult. But I love doing those. I mean, some people, I admired the way David Coleman done them over the years. And I finished up with doing quite a few. I would love to have done London. In fact, I did London, but only for the World Feed, which has probably meant that more people listened to me than listened to Hugh Edwards.
Yeah.
And the BBC made a strange decision to nothing against Hugh, but why they turned Beijing into a political thing rather than a sporting thing. I think that was a mistake. I mean, he did well enough. I've never listened to how it went, but he's a very professional broadcaster. I used to like it very much.
Is there a sport that you wish you had had a chance to commentate on?
No, there were sports I knew I shouldn't do. No, I mean, I couldn't do golf because I played very rarely in my life. I don't think you have to be a great player, but it helps to know the language, apart from anything else, of the sport. And cricket is the same. Mm. Although I love cricket, but I wouldn't want, if I wanted to be a commentator on cricket, I had to be Richie Benaud. And if I wanted to be a commentator on, my two favourite commentators are Benaud, and from an earlier age, John Arlott, who was also a very good radio football commentator. Football.
Oh, right.
He did. People don't remember that. Obviously, it's time gone now, but he was extremely good. He was the guy who, Froggatt he once came out with a remark about over an England match that the best centre half in England plays for Portsmouth on the left wing, and the best left wing in England plays for Finchley, which happened at that time to be my local club. And George Roth did make it when he turned professional with Tottenham. Sort of remark of great confidence and knowledge. And Froggatt did play.
There you go.
He was wonderful. I did a programme with him, with Ian Wooldridge, many moons ago for Forces Broadcasting. They had a series of talking to people days before podcasts. He was just fascinating to talk to. And I asked him about, it was sort of question like, if he had the opportunity to have been the commentator on a particular occasion, what would it have been? And thinking he would talk about Jack Hobbs or maybe even W.J. Grimsby. And he said, Gladstone's Midlothian campaign. Fortunately, I remember the simplest question that an interviewer can ask. Why? And he told me, because I had no idea about that's good Midlothian campaign. But apparently it was as much to get him in back as Prime Minister. I can't remember now what his reasons were, but I think the oratory from before the days of microphones and things like that was what impressed him to a great degree.
Well, just finally then, Barry, I'll throw that question that you threw at John Arlott back at you and ask you the same thing that you asked of him. Is there a sporting occasion which you wish you could have been behind the mic for?
Well, I could say a few cup finals, but I don't want to go there.
Like I said, that's been fun.
No, actually, I did a little bit of several Royal Mayor shows, which I don't know whether people will remember. But it's a very appropriate day for you to ask me this question, because I would love to have been the commentator at the Cenotaph. I would love to have had that opportunity. I was plucked to do out of sport to do the Lord Mayor's show by a producer who said, I've asked for you. So I said, what do I mean? And I enjoyed it very much.
Well, I know that you would have provided the Cenotaph commentary with the gravitas that it deserves, because that's pretty much what your commentary career, for me, if I'm speaking personally, has all been about, Barry. It's been about gravitas. You've added, lended weight to everything you've ever, you know, spoken about as a commentator. And I'm actually really honoured to have had the chance to speak to you today, because it's something I never thought I'd get the chance to do.
Well, I've enjoyed it very much. I don't like waffling on about myself. I probably in some situations didn't push myself enough, but I enjoyed what I did. I got paid for a hobby. And every so often, you know, I'm finding now that people ring me up and say, I'm writing a book. And then ask me for my memories of a commentary that I did back 40 years ago. And as you will find out, as you get a little bit older, I think I've got so many names of sports people in my head somewhere. Sometimes there's not room for people that I know so well. I mean, forgetting your son's godfather or something like that.
Yeah.
The name, knowing him, but Fred, no, not Fred, not Bill.
By the way, it was nice just finally, as we wrap things up, to see you and Motti sat together at Watford the other week, and that the cameras were suddenly trained on you. And I think you more than Motti realised that the camera was suddenly trained on the pair of you. And I think you gave Motti a little nudge, as if to say, "Smile, you're on candid camera."
Yeah, it was an idea. I thought it would be very amusing. The only regret I had about it was that Gary Lineker was not the presenter that night, because Gary would have had some line that he would have used at the end, which would be really good.
No doubt.
I'm very delighted to hear from Margaret since that that he was totally blind in one eye, and the other one wasn't really, really good. And he couldn't watch television properly. But he was told about this two shot. And he was particularly pleased, because I mean, Motti would tell you that he was much help to him as well. And John was the radio commentator who moved to television, whereas I was the guy who came in from the outside, as it were. Tell people the story of the first time we had a conversation. He said to me, "Anytime you think you can help, please tell me. I won't, I'll be pleased to learn anything," which was very big of him. I hadn't been there that long myself all the time. I said to him, "I'll give you a piece of advice straight away." He said, if when you reach the age that he is, I was referring to Ken Wolstenholme, and they offer you a contract that they just offered him, take it before they change their minds. And I was talking to the man who would break all of Ken Wolstenholme's records. I want to see the funny side of that. So see you.
There you go. Listen, Barry, I say again, I'm so thrilled to have had the chance to chat to you for this podcast. And thank you so much for giving up your time.
Maybe our paths were crossed. You never know.
Oh, it would be so nice if it did. But thank you for your time, Barry. Thank you so much.
Bye.
My eternal thanks once again to Barry Davis for joining me on The Commentator's Curse. I do hope you've enjoyed our conversation as well. And the next episode of this show will be along in due course with another couple of guests to talk about their journey into this weird world that us commentators inhabit. Thanks for your time. Thanks once again to Barry Davis. You've been listening to The Commentator's Curse.